From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, new Boston City Council President Kim Janey and her goals for the months ahead.
It's really important that you go where the people are and you make government as accessible as it possibly can be, as well as transparent as it can be.
Also today, if everything has become political, has it also become exhausting?
This support group is for people who are so woke that they are finding it impossible to have any fun at all.
We'll take your calls. And Errol Morris's new film puts him in conversation with Steve Bannon.
Lucifer, for me, had certain Bannon-esque qualities.
He's the interesting character in Paradise Lost.
Rather reign in hell
than serve in heaven. Love that line.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Kim Janey was sworn in as the new president of the Boston City Council. She will oversee the most diverse council in history. She's spending a few minutes with us today to talk about what's on her docket for the next 2 years. Council President Janey, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
So what are you most excited about as the new city council president?
Oh, I am so excited to enter this new decade, which is just an exciting time going into a new year, but a new decade, and leading the most diverse council in Boston's history. That is something that should be celebrated. We now have the first Afro-Latina woman on the city council. We have the first openly gay woman on the council. It is amazing time, and it was a great day. It is a great day in the city of Boston, and I am thrilled because representation matters.
So it's a new decade and a truly new council. What are your priorities?
Yes. So the overarching priority for me is to ensure that we are doing all we can in our city to include everyone. I want us to really prioritize equity and inclusion. Boston is an amazing city. It is my hometown. I love it dearly. And I think about all the great things that are in our city. I think about this economic boom that we're experiencing. But I also think about the people who are being left out of that. And that is what inspired me to run for office. It is what inspired me to run for the council presidency. I think there are big issues that we have to tackle, whether it's housing, whether it's transportation, you know, public transit, whether it's traffic and congestion in our city, our schools. You know, I'm a big advocate for education,
jobs. Actually, can you tell me a little bit more? You have been a big advocate for education. Can you tell me a little more about what your agenda for the schools would be?
Yes. Well, I think first and foremost, again, ensuring that we are doing all we can to eliminate the opportunity and achievement gap. While we can celebrate all the success of Boston Public Schools, and there has been a lot of progress, and we can certainly celebrate that. That's great. But when we dig deeper and peel back the onion, we see that there are still big gaps between Black students and white students, Latino students and white students. We see gaps around program areas. So our students with disabilities, students who are learning English, there are gaps. So even though scores are going up, there are persistent gaps between different program areas and different along racial lines that we've got to close. We have to ensure that all of our young people have access to a world-class education that prepares them for college and career success. All of our young people should have Harvard on their college application list. They may choose a different school, and that's fine, but they should be able to get into the best. That is what we have here. We have the best colleges and universities here within our city, and our young people should be prepared to enter into those universities.
You came right out of the gate yesterday with an initiative around payment in lieu of taxes or pilot payments by the large nonprofits in the city who don't pay property taxes. Can you sort of square the circle for us between that focus coming right out of the gate and the kinds of things you're talking about, equity and inclusion and student achievement, et cetera? Can you connect those dots?
Yeah, well, I think the reason why pilot and thinking about our agreement with our nonprofit partners is important is because there's so much money that is being left on the table.
What would you do with that money?
We could invest it in our schools. We could invest it in our roads. We could invest it in affordable housing. We know that the city of Boston, so during my first term, so the first 2 years, the city of Boston requested $213 million through the pilot program. But we only received $68 million, or 32%. And that was $145 million, though, that was left on the table, $145 million that is left on the table. By creating this city council committee, it elevates the conversation in a different way. It creates a platform for the pilot action group and other advocates who want to come together to think about creative ways or new ideas that we want to put on the table in working with our nonprofit partners. And, you know, I want to say, you know, on the record that our universities, our hospitals, provide an important service to our community. They're a huge economic engine, and we love that they call Boston home.
Have you heard from any of them in response to this since you announced it?
I haven't, not yet. I am in communication with Northeastern on a number of issues and have a meeting scheduled with them, and so I know that will come up, and Northeastern is in my district, and unfortunately Northeastern is one of the big four that falls short when it comes to paying their fair share of pilot.
You've also been quite vocal on pushing to hold more city council meetings at night and in various parts of the city. Why is that important to you?
It is so important because we have to make sure that city government is more accessible to the people that we serve. To ask people to come downtown in the middle of the day on a Wednesday for a council meeting doesn't seem like the best idea if we want people engaged, if we want to have a democratic process where people are truly engaged in the work and the business of the council. And so the thinking is that we could rotate. Each of the district councilors could host one of our city council meetings in the district, and we could, you know, really, if I host, I can really make sure that the turnout is there and maybe, help engage residents and giving them the opportunity to perhaps speak at the beginning of the meeting. The other thing is our council meetings are just that for us. It is a hearing that residents can come and testify at a hearing, but they can't do so in a meeting. But perhaps we create a space for them to do that.
Why hasn't the council done this before, do you think?
I don't know why the council hasn't done it before, but I would suggest, I would say that the council has been doing more and more of its work in community. I certainly have hosted several hearings in the community, and I think it's really important that you go where the people are and you make government as accessible as it possibly can be, as well as transparent as it can be. That is why it's important.
So, Council President Janey, last question for you. The Mayor's State of the City address is tonight. What do you want to hear from Mayor Marty Walsh?
I would love to hear more about how we create opportunities for everyone in our city to share in the economic benefits of living in Boston.
That's Boston City Council President Kim Janey. Councilor Janey, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And before we break, I just want to invite listeners to tune back in to WBUR tonight at 7 o'clock for a special edition of Radio Boston covering Mayor Marty Walsh's State of the City address. We'll have live analysis from Jennifer Nasur and Michael Curry. Again, that's tonight at 7 o'clock on 90.9 WBUR. Meanwhile, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Okay, for this next segment, we were trying to figure out the best way to set it up for you, the conversation that we're inviting both our panelists and our listeners to have. And we decided that the easiest way to do that was kind of pull back the curtain and tell you about a conversation we had as we were preparing for the show this morning. So here in Studio 3, our producers Paris Alston and Sarah Rose Brenner, who were both part of this morning's chat. Paris and Sarah Rose, hi. Hello, Tiziana.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So listen, it all started when we were chatting about a moment from Ricky Gervais at the Golden Globes on Sunday night, mocking the Hollywood folk in the audience for their wokeness.
Well, you say you're woke, but the companies you work for, I mean, unbelievable. Apple, Amazon, Disney. If ISIS started a streaming service, you'd call your agent, wouldn't you? So if you do win an award tonight, don't use it as a platform to make a political speech, right? You're in no position to lecture the public about anything. You know nothing about the real world. Most of you spent less time in school than Greta Thunberg.
So he goes on to exhort everyone, hey, if you win an award, get up here, thank your people. I think he says, thank your God, and then get the heck off stage. There may have been a few more expletives than that. So we were chatting about that this morning and kind of the zeitgeist it captures. Paris, how did that moment strike you, and how would you characterize the conversation we had?
So first of all, I just keep going back to the faces in the audience. It was kind of like one of those moments when everyone's looking around like, is he really saying this? And people were kind of laughing, but not really laughing. And he was also, as I think Sarah Rose pointed out, kind of hypocritical because he's up there pontificating on all these political points when he just told everyone not to do that.
Right. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I thought it was funny. I laughed, but I wasn't a famous person in the audience, so I'm not sure if he got the reception he was going for. It's like Paris mentioned, like, I thought it was a little hypocritical because before he got into that, he was talking about Jeffrey Epstein and the lack of diversity among the major categories. So
you felt he was already being political.
Right. Like, you went and you were political. You had your stage. Why can't other people do the same?
And that led us to a conversation this morning about the tensions between our need and our desire to increasingly be aware of the politics and social justice of a variety of situations and kind of the fatigue that comes with that. Paris, is everything political? Should it be?
In today's age, especially as a millennial, and I think a lot of different generations can relate to this, but especially with us having social media and all these pressures from our friends to be woke and things like that, it feels like everything is political, and you have to really watch what you say, especially on platforms like Twitter, Instagram, all of that, because someone is waiting to point out that you're being politically incorrect or insensitive. But also, sometimes I think it's okay to lighten up a little bit and realize that this world is so complicated, and sometimes you have to be able to release and even make light of certain things, and kind of sometimes you just want to live and do the things you want to do without them being criticized.
Sarah Rose, you're nodding.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. I think it does feel like everything is political, so I'm just going to go ahead and say everything is political, but I don't mind that because there's so many important things happening that if it is everywhere, it's because it should be, and I think that people should be aware enough, like, if you need a break, you need to step back, then just take a step back and take a break. And there's nothing wrong with that, and people shouldn't feel bad. But I think it's important that the issues are getting out there, even though people might say, like, oh, I'm so tired.
So there you have it, listeners. That was what started the whole thing. And we realized it's time to have a conversation about this. Let's invite some guests in who we think are smarter than we are to think about that and invite your calls to say, hey, should politics and social justice pervade everything we do? Do you need to be woke aware all the time? Do you need a refuge? Do you deserve a refuge? What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. So now we're going to pull the curtain back over. We're going to invite Paris and Sarah Rose. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much, Tiziana.
We're going to invite them to go back to work, and we're going to turn to some panelists now that we've got it set up. So let's turn to those guests. First, joining me here in the studio is Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, an activist and organizer. Reverend Mariama, welcome back. Great to have you.
It's good to be here.
And on the line is Hiawatha Bray, Boston Globe business and tech writer. Hiawatha, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Yeah, great to be here. And I'm not talking about tech either.
That's right. It's great to have you on any number of subjects, Hiawatha. So I kind of want to jump into it here. What were your reactions, Hiawatha? I'll start with you, to, you know, what you just heard from our producers, from Paris and Sarah Rose.
Well, yeah, I'm one of those people who does think that we have we sometimes overwhelm ourselves with this need to turn everything that we see, everything that we think, everything that we talk about into a political issue. And in a way, it almost becomes almost anti-political in some cases, because instead of being able to do what people really ought to do in terms of political issues, which is to have honest debates about the subjects that concern us, it becomes basically an opportunity to tell other people to shut up. So many of our so-called political debates don't amount to debates at all. I mean,
do
I think
you
of the
feel
Greta
shut
Thunberg
up, Hiawatha, often by
not
these discussions?
Me. No, 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 no. But I think it's pretty clear that a lot of Americans do feel as though they're walking on eggs whenever they open their mouths about any particular issue because of the way we argue about these things. It isn't even that things are political. It's the way we argue about politics.
Let me turn to Reverend Mariama here, Hiawatha, because she's nodding several times in that comment from you. Go ahead.
So I think the reality is that everything is political. I think that's partially true and not always like political as in political parties. But the reality is like there's a lot of things about our lives that benefit some people and hurt other people. And, you know, we have to have those conversations. I think what Hiawatha is saying that I think is really important is I'm not upset that we're having the conversations because I think there have been many times in our history where some of us have been asked to suffer in silence, where we haven't had the space to have the conversation. The question is how we're having the conversation. And I think there are two trends that are disturbing at the same time that more of the conversation has. So glad we're opening up these topics. However, there's two things. One, I think we struggle to just know how to have basic dialogue with each other. I have the experience of being on the train and seeing all of us, you know, on our phones, like, you know, totally engrossed. And there was a really good article that came out, I think it might have been in the Washington Post or the Times, I can't remember which one right now, that talked about how people literally spend all of their time on the phones because they're afraid to have a conversation with a stranger. And, you know, these scientists actually pushed people to have the conversation. And when the folks who did have the conversation rated the experience as better than the folks who didn't. But in reality, most of us think, oh, my gosh, I don't want to have a conversation with this person. What if we don't agree? We're going to have this. So our ability to have good, healthy dialogue, we're losing it.
Okay, what's the second thing?
The second thing is that I think we've seen a decline in the spaces in our communities where we can talk and we can notice things we have in common beyond traditional political stuff. So there's fewer of us bowling. There's fewer of us in garden clubs. There's fewer of us going to churches or synagogues. There's fewer of us in spaces where we're able to build with another human being over something that maybe isn't so political, and that's just about the things we love to do and being in relationship with each other.
So Hiawatha, go ahead.
Absolutely, I think that is absolutely brilliant. You're almost making my skin crawl here because it occurs to me you're the pastor of a church. I'm a deacon in a church, and I think that may give us both an advantage. Mm-hmm. I don't know what your politics are, you know what my politics are, but we both go to church. And one of the huge advantages of being somebody who goes to a church is we're constantly surrounded by different kinds of people. We take it for granted that the world's full of people who aren't like us, and we must learn to love and get along with them because that's what our religion teaches. Our religion teaches. And as religious attachment declines in American society, I think that's a major reason for a lot of the hostility and bitterness that we see in all directions, because people don't go someplace every week where they're constantly being taught, hey, that person next to you who voted for Trump or who voted for Hillary Clinton, that's still your brother or sister, and you have to love that person.
Let's take a call.
A lot of people are not learning that. They're not learning that.
Let's take a call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kevin, I want you to join the conversation. What do you want to share with Hiawatha and Reverend Mariama?
Well, thanks very much. You had kind of rhetorically asked, do we get a break from all this wokeness and social justice? And I'd like to say that the poor don't get a break, so we don't get a break.
So no luxury of fatigue when people are experiencing fatigue in their lives every day, Kevin?
It's a luxury the poor can't afford.
Thanks for that, Kevin. And Kevin was calling from Orleans, Massachusetts. Reverend Mariama, your reaction to Kevin?
Well, I mean, I think that Kevin has a good point. Like one of the things, one of my teachers in seminary says that my job as a pastor is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. The reality is there are some folks who are struggling, and some of us shouldn't get to just live our lives acting like those folks are not there or acting like they're not experiencing real challenges. At the same time, I think there is still this conversation about how we have the conversation. And I say this to my parishioners, like, when was the last time someone yelled in your face and you walked away from that going, you know what? I'm so thankful for the feedback that you just offered me, and I'm going to go and change.
Hiawatha, why are you laughing?
You know?
Because what you're saying is absolutely true. The tone in which we conduct our discourse in this society is absurd, and it's outrageous. And the idea that anybody is going to become a better person for being abused on Twitter is just, where do people even get that idea?
So let me take a pause here for a second, though. The outrageous and the strong, as we become increasingly aware of, as we increase our interdependence and become aware of the impact that our choices have, sometimes they're a really big deal.
Oh, so certainly.
So how does one express the breadth and depth of that and not be outrageous?
Well, and so this is one of the things that's interesting. One of my things is that I think a lot of us are focused on anger either because we like to look at the sty in somebody else's eye without looking at our own, and because I think we have a hard time with grief. And I think I encourage my folks, when I look at the world, there are many times that I see beautiful things. I'm sitting on the train. I see a young person. But I see a lot of pain. I mean, as a pastor, whenever I have to go to the courthouse, I'm so sad to see young people in there whose lives are moving on the wrong track, and we can all tell it. But I don't walk away from that grief, and it doesn't have to right away convert to anger. Sometimes we need to just sit with that grief and say, I don't want to live in a world like this. And then ask the question, what do I need to do to shift it? And sometimes our first answer is, what do I need to tell somebody else what to shift? And less, what do I need to do? What do I need to participate in to shift this?
Let's take another call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Paul on the line from Brookline. Paul, what's on your mind?
Hi. Good afternoon. First, I'm really happy to be on with your guests. I enjoy both of them a lot when I hear them. My observation, extending a little bit of what was just said, when I heard Mr. Gervais in the intro, I heard him scolding these people and warning them to not talk from a position of privilege when they're not doing anything real in their lives to create change. They're ineffective, and they're just throwing criticism without actually doing anything to make the world a better place. So I don't know if it's fatigue as much as it is, don't be hypocritical and don't be sanctimonious.
Let's have Hiawatha pick that up, Paul.
I don't know. I mean, I got to tell you, I saw this and I thought it was, in some ways, some of it was disgusting. And Paul, some of the jokes he told were awful. But in the main, I thought it was brilliant. And I was listening because I thought, I have felt that way so many times. And I'm listening to somebody who's rich and powerful hectoring me and hectoring my fellow Americans about what we are doing wrong. And it is deeply offensive at times to hear that going on from people. And it's not because they aren't doing enough, I think. I think it's because of the lack of humility and the lack of a sense of equality. If some of the same celebrities were talking about these issues in ways that said, I'm your fellow citizen, I'm your fellow human being, I'm your fellow American, let's talk together about what we should be doing about this. Maybe we can have, you know, meetings where we talk, and I'm not going to lecture you, I'm not going to tell you what to think, I'm just going to try to meet you as another human being. And so little of this discourse is like that, and I think that's why so many people really feel resentment about it, and sometimes I do too.
Let's take another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to pull up your own seat at the table. We've got Doug on the line from Hyde Park. Doug, go ahead.
Hi, I just want to thank you for having me on. I respect our religious leaders and their opinions. I actually know Mariama very well. I think the reason that we're all hostile to each other is obviously the leader in the White House has created this atmosphere where it has created an atmosphere where we're hostile to each other when we don't agree. And I kind of am falling into that trap myself because I'm so angry all the time, given how he has treated a lot of people, racist, sexist.
Doug, what about the argument that he's a symptom, that the approach that the president uses, which we know is an inflammatory approach, is a symptom of where we are as a country, not the cause of where we are as a country?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I guess my final point is he is a symptom, and the fact that there's so many people that after 3 years still support him and are okay with him separating families at the border, having the attitude that he has. You're right, it's absolutely a symptom, which is why we are so hostile to each other, because it's gotten to a point where we're so different in opinion and how we want this country that I think people focus too much on the leader in the White House. He's exacerbated the problem, but he's also pointed out that this country is very sexist, very racist, and a lot of our religious leaders, not our wonderful guest on the line, but a lot of the religious leaders have become very hypocritical. So, it's hard for me to take
Doug, I'm going to pick it up from you from there. I really appreciate it, and especially since you know Reverend Mariama, I'm going to turn to her for a response.
I mean, I think that what Doug is raising, you know, is true. I don't think it helps us in any way when the person with one of our biggest platforms in the world is exacerbating this. I think it was interesting.
He is not the only one.
But he's not. He's not. What's interesting to me about it is that he is, you know, he's a little bit of a television personality. And when I look at what was happening on the Golden Globes, so there's a tension here because you're right. They have a lot of privilege. I'm like, you know, you spent the last 2 weeks just trying to figure out your dress while, you know, other people were dealing with some more serious
issues.
Putting
food on the table.
Right? But that being said, the problem is that we are a starstruck nation, and they didn't make that. We're the ones, I think, unfortunately, as we have lost more and more space for measured and thoughtful people to be at the center of our conversation, as we ourselves have gravitated to more divisive figures on both sides, and as we have ceded to sports stars and you know, movie stars to have the largest platform in our country, I think some of them feel like, well, if I have a platform, shouldn't I be using it in a positive way? Now, I'm not saying that I'm going to turn to any of them for the, you know, the space, but I think, again, the problem is, to some extent, they are stepping into a vacuum that we have created because we're not sitting down with our neighbors. We're not having dinner with the folks we are go to religious services with. We're not even, you know, in enough interaction with the folks that our kids go to school with. So when we don't create the good forums for the healthy conversation, we create a vacuum into which other people are stepping. And I agree that they're not the best folks. I understand why they feel like they need to say something.
Let's put Hiawatha in here, too, both in reaction to Reverend Mariama, but also in reaction to Doug, if you want, the caller who prompted this part of the conversation.
Well, no, I think I don't think there's anything I would particularly push back against, except, yeah, I absolutely agree. Well, you all agreed that Trump is not the cause of this. If anything, I would say that one of the reasons he got elected was the very reason why that Ricky Gervais monologue, I just glanced, it's gotten 8 million views on YouTube. And that doesn't count all the people who've seen excerpts of it or read about it. There are millions of people for whom that resentment and anger about being constantly preached at by people who live really not very appealing lives, a lot of people really feel that. And but it's not a solution. It's not a cure to say, well, now we're going to get back at you. I really feel that a lot of the things that drives this popularity of Trump is, here's a guy who's going to talk back to all these know-it-alls who are always telling us what's wrong with us. But that doesn't get us anywhere. It just keeps the cycle going. And you just know that people on the left, whenever they come back to power, there's going to be more and more of this attitude toward, well, the people who didn't vote for us, we don't have to pay any attention to them. We're just going to trash each other indefinitely, is the feeling that one gets. And we have to figure out some way to break the cycle. And right at this moment, I'm not sure anybody even wants to break the cycle.
So we've got a full set of lines, and I want to grab at least one more caller. So let's take Colby from East Boston. Colby, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a pro-life lawyer, and my law school dean told me she had never met a pro-life person before.
How'd that make you feel, Colby?
But I have to look at all the causes that pop up, and I also have 8 children and 16 grandchildren, so
Whoa.
I have to pace myself. I can't take every single issue onto my plate, but I have to be like the story of the Good Samaritan. You have to help the person that you run into.
Thanks for that, Colby. I saw Reverend Mariama nodding, so I'm going to turn to you.
Well, I mean, I think the reality is, we can't ask people. I joke with people all the time, you know, I worship Jesus and I'm very clear that I'm not him and neither are you, right? And so I don't think any of us can be perfect. But I want to see all of us trying. And I appreciate what Colby said. Like, we can't all end homelessness and racism. And we can't do all of those things, right? But all of us could be doing something. And the reality is, I think not enough of us are actually doing things where we dig in and take it seriously and build real relationships with people. I push back on some of the activists. And again, I'm an activist. I believe in activism. But if all you're doing is sort of clicking here and rallying there and you're not really digging in with real people and building relationships, I do think that it can keep things in the purely theoretical and political realm and never help us to get to the real human.
Okay, so I'm going to take
I quickly have to interject one more thing, because I am a tech reporter, and I'm here to tell you, but the people who invented the stuff I write about every day have clearly got a lot to do with what's going on here. We have communication without real content, without real contact with the people we're communicating with, and it has changed the way we talk to each other. There can be no question that services like Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, are part of the reason this stuff is happening. We no longer know the people we're berating, and that's why we talk to each other the way we do.
All right. So listen, just very quickly, we aren't going to have time for any more calls, but our lines were full and we had more people calling in. Listeners, if you didn't get to comment and you want to, Facebook, Twitter, at Radio Boston, post your comments. We'd like to know. Okay. So Reverend Mariama, two words, final thought.
I still have hope.
Excellent. And Hiawatha?
Log off.
Log off. Can I tell you how much I loved this conversation with the two of you? That was Hiawatha Bray, Boston Globe business and tech writer. Hiawatha, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester and activist and organizer, thank you so much as well.
Thank you. And talk to a stranger, guys.
And listeners, Absolutely. Thank you. It was wonderful to have your calls, have this kind of kitchen table conversation. Let's do more of it. Meanwhile, coming up, Errol Morris's new film puts him in conversation with Steve Bannon. We'll hear from Morris himself. There's more coming up. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Lucifer, for me, had certain Bannon-esque qualities.
He's the interesting character in Paradise Lost.
Rather reign in hell
than serve in heaven. Love that line. I use it all the time.
You do?
Oh, yeah, all the time. There's a lot of truth to that.
So that's filmmaker Errol Morris talking with Steve Bannon in a scene from Morris's latest documentary called American Dharma. Bannon, of course, was CEO for Donald Trump's political campaign, went on to serve as chief strategist in the White House in 2017. He was also executive chairman of Breitbart News until early 2018. So Steve Bannon styles himself as a warrior for the working class, kind of in the vein of war heroes in old black and white movies. But Morris didn't see him that way. He was in Studio 3 recently to talk about the film, and I asked him why make a film about Bannon in the first place.
I've done a lot of bad guys in my career. Badness, evil, whatever you want to call it, fascinates me.
When you started, you assumed he was a bad guy, an evil guy, when you reached out to him?
I assumed that he was responsible for one of the worst things that's happened in my lifetime, and that would be the election of Donald Trump.
When you finished your conversation with him, did you think he was a bad guy, an evil guy?
I thought he was a crazy guy.
So say some more about that.
If I know what's going to happen in an interview, I say to myself, well, why bother doing it? I do them because I hope to learn something. I don't know what. And I'm always looking for a different way in. Doesn't matter exactly what that way in, but it has to be different if you expect to get something that you haven't heard before. And my way in was through his obsession with the movies, in particular, a 1949 movie 12 O'Clock High starring Gregory Peck. Yes.
And so is that how you invited him? I mean, because one of the things that I wondered almost immediately as I was watching American Dharma was it hard to get him to say yes? He knows you. He knows your work. He talked about the fact that he knew your work. Did he want to do the interview or did you have to coax him into it?
He wanted to do it. He was flattered. He was flattered that I wanted to make a movie about him.
I want to pull a quote here for a second. This is,
You compare at one point, and it is a little later in the film, but you compare Bannon to Lucifer in Milton's Paradise Lost, and he goes with it. Let's listen to that for a second.
I was reading about Lucifer in Milton's Paradise Lost, and I have to say that Lucifer, for me, had certain Bannon-esque qualities.
He's the interesting character in Paradise Lost.
Rather reign in hell
than serve in heaven. Love that line. I use it all the time.
You do?
Oh, yeah, all the time. There's a lot of truth to that.
So I'm watching and I'm thinking, as you're talking, I'm thinking, holy cow, he just compared Bannon to Lucifer, and Bannon loves it. Now, you've said you went in thinking he was, you came out thinking he was crazy. Who does he think he is? What do you think his image or his view of himself is?
My movies usually, I wouldn't say always, but usually are about some kind of self-deception. A person who imagines themselves one way, but we see them differently. Bannon sees himself in many ways as a classic Hollywood hero. But I don't see him as a hero. Far from it. And one of the central ironies of American Dharma is this comparison of himself with Gregory Peck, with General Savage. Here's a movie about our fight against Nazi Germany, against fascism. And then whatever it is, 60, 70 years later, he sees himself as that same kind of hero.
So he does really see politics as war. There's a really interesting quote where he says, "This is war." I want to play that.
So this is war.
It's absolutely war. At that level of politics, it's war. You're fighting for control of the greatest country in the world. It's war.
You know, for centuries, we've compared war and politics, right? It's two things you're not supposed to talk about at the dinner table. Did he turn politics into more war than it was before? Or is he just a reflection of what politics has always been, right? Which was what a war by other means.
An impossible question, at least for me to answer. But does he see it as war? Absolutely. He uses endless war imagery. Trump is an armor-piercing shell.
Calls him a killer.
A killer. What this country needs, I, by the way, would beg to differ, is killers. We need less killers, not more killers.
There were several things that made me uncomfortable. Some of which...
Good!
Some I think you intended, and then some I didn't know if you intended.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you a little bit of both. One of the things I wondered, so my husband and I watched it together, and we had many conversations. We would pause and talk with each other and then watch some more.
I hope you started fighting.
We actually didn't. We had very similar views about it. But one of the questions that we asked ourselves was, does he think Bannon's telling him the truth? There are many stories that Bannon tells you of how things happened during the campaign in those early days at the White House, you know, decisions James Comey made about the intelligence briefing that he provided President Trump on Russia. Do you believe he was telling you the truth?
Well, I don't believe anybody I talk to, including yourself, I might add, forgive me, is always telling the truth. Part of our job, my job, is to figure out what's true and what's false. Do I think that Bannon is always telling the truth? Of course I don't. But what he's telling me is interesting and important and thought-provoking.
There were a couple of places where you talk about the metaphor of the films that you use. It was part of the way that you attracted him to have this conversation. And it was a conversation to some extent. One of the things that struck me was, and you said this is to some extent, there's a story of self-deception here, was his lack of awareness that the people that he was idolizing were this traditional military or cowboy white male mentality. We had John Wayne, we had Gregory Peck, we had Alec Guinness in Bridge on the River Kwai. And he didn't seem aware that he was idolizing something that was awful for a lot of people. And I didn't hear you point that out to him. Did you want to make him aware, and should you have pushed him on the fact that what he was idolizing, a lot of people would not say those were the good old days we ought to be trying to get back to with a workers' party?
Occasionally, I challenged him, questioned the views that he had. A number of reviewers said, well, you didn't ask questions that were hard enough, and you didn't ask hard enough questions often enough.
What do you think of that criticism?
I don't agree. This is not about asking difficult questions.
But why isn't it? I really want to hear from you on that, because he is so seductive that if you don't ask him difficult questions, it would be very easy for him to put out a message that is unchallenged and well-packaged.
I call him a racist. I tell him that I believe he's insane.
You do. You tell him you think he's crazy. But when you call him a racist, what was interesting to me is he never answers you. Did he never answer you, or did you just not show the part? He says, you think I'm racist, and you say yes, and then that's it. He never says anything.
He has a whole number of techniques at his disposal. I've seen a lot of interviews with Stephen K. Bannon. Too many. They've probably done some kind of consequent brain damage. He goes into a filibuster mode. He will bore you to death. The stump speech, if you like. The movies, for me, was a way of getting around that to something different. If I had wanted to do a straight adversarial interview, I suppose I could. It's not my style. I've seen many adversarial interviews with Steve Bannon that produce nothing.
Does he win him?
No, he doesn't win him. He bores the pants off of you. You learn nothing. Okay, I'm interested in learning stuff.
What do you want the viewer to learn from this movie?
I want them to embrace and think about some of the ironies here, that some of the most beloved American movies, beloved by me, I might add, John Ford in particular.
You had Orson Welles, you had Stanley Kubrick.
There's a lot of stuff in there. It scared me to think that movies are, I don't know what the exact word is, they accommodate everything. They're strangely fungible. May not be the right word, but I'll use it anyway. You can apply any interpretation you like. And for Bannon, his use of dharma, his use of destiny, his use of duty, it really frightened me, because I thought, here is an ideology that justifies everything and anything. All you have to do is say, well, it's my dharma to do this. It's my duty to do this. It's my destiny to do this. And then everything else falls away. There he is, just before the second debate with Hillary Clinton, ordering people either get on the campaign plane or you're off the campaign.
I think Chris Christie was one of the people he said that to.
It's a do or die mission, just like General Savage describes to his troops in 12 O'Clock High. If I made one mistake, and I probably made many, many, many mistakes in making this movie, is assuming that people were familiar with these movies, they would see the connection between the Quonset hut where I filmed Bannon, it's something that I built, I constructed, that absolutely mimics the Quonset hut in 12 O'Clock High.
At first I thought maybe you'd actually gotten the same set.
Nope. Had to build it. But there you go. There's a metaphor if you like, at the heart of this. It's a man's dream. A man's dream of being a hero in a Hollywood movie, a 1940s Hollywood movie, celebrating our fight against Nazi Germany. What could possibly, now I'm speaking as the filmmaker, what could possibly, for me, be more ironic?
So that makes me think, and I hadn't had this thought until just this moment. Is it possible that somebody so sure of their dharma, their duty, their destiny, and so willing to use total political war or other forms of coercion to get it cannot be challenged with subtlety or irony? Is it possible? And I have to be honest, I hope the answer is no. But is it possible that one has to do direct conflict, do direct debate, or the irony gets drowned, or the subtlety, the art of it gets drowned in the sheer force of the other person's, you know, he's a smart, seductive, driven, singularly focused man. Do you understand what I'm...
I understand completely what you're saying, and I agree with it in part. Should we be scared of this man? You betcha. Should we be looking at this man and thinking about this man? The fact that he scared you is good. People have talked about this trilogy of films that I made, a film about Robert S. McNamara,
Fog of War.
A film about Donald Rumsfeld, and now a film about Stephen Bannon. One thing that changed, and it's quite interesting to me, with McNamara, years and years and years had passed since the Vietnam War. I was interviewing him in the 90s. The war was over in the 70s. When I interviewed Donald Rumsfeld, the Iraq War was not that far behind us, much closer to us. And there was considerable anger about both of those films, more about Rumsfeld, because I think we were closer. Not I think we were closer. We were closer to another one of the worst debacles in American history, a debacle that is continuing to affect us. And then Bannon. And the difference here, quite clearly, is we're still in the thick of it. Nothing's over. We're in the middle. America is in the middle of one of the worst nightmares in our history. Should I have not made the movie because of that? Too subtle, too ironic, too whatever? I don't know. Am I to be condemned for too much subtlety, for too much irony? Why not?
So
I can
next?
Take it. I can take it. I like to think of myself as a filmmaker. I'm making these films, of course, for other people, but I'm also making them for myself. I'm trying to think about the issues, thinking about what went into this campaign. We all want to pretend that he isn't there, that this isn't really happening, that this is some kind of a strange nightmare and that we'll all wake up. But I think it's a nightmare that we have to deal with it, and I tried to deal with it in my own way. I tried to make people think about it. If I was unsuccessful, okay, I'm sorry.
That's filmmaker Errol Morris. American Dharma will be screening at the Brattle Theater through Thursday. Errol, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on today.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. We'll be on again tonight at 7 for live coverage of Mayor Marty Walsh's State of the City Address, and then join us again tomorrow at 3 for an all-new Radio Boston.